Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hello there, how are you doing? I hope you're well. Now, if you would like to improve your spoken English, one of the best ways to do that is to actually talk to native English speakers. And I know that a lot of you don't really have access to many native speakers where you are. But now, with iTalki, you can speak to native speakers as often as you want, whenever you want. And it's all done on the internet. It's brilliant. You can just do it in your living room. You could sit on the sofa and have a chat with a native speaker, or if you want more structured learning, you could get in touch with an English teacher. They have it's brilliant. They have loads and loads of teachers. They teach lots of different languages. They've got tons of English teachers. Go to teacherluke.co.uk/talk to get started. And when you buy some lessons or some conversation time, you will get a discount. iTalki will send you a voucher which is worth 100 iTalki credits, which you can use in the future. That's not bad. That's not bad at all. Okay, then. So check that out. Do check that out. Right. Okay, let's start this episode then. Here we go.
Ladies and gentlemen,
this is Luke's English Podcast.
Can't touch this.
This is a masterpiece of the English language.
All righty then.
Just think of the accolades it's received over the years.
Wait a minute. Who are you?
I'm Luke Skywalker. I'm here to rescue you.
Ooh, this is going to be good.
Really?
Yes.
I want to get into it, man.
Ladies and gentlemen,
this is Luke's English Podcast.
And this is Britain at its best.
Oh, you lucky people!
Hello there, welcome to the podcast. How are you doing? I hope you're well. I'm fine, thanks. It's very hot here in Paris today on this Friday, late afternoon on a Friday as I record this. Quite hot and humid. I have to talk about the weather, okay? I have to, because I'm English. It's just what we do, all right? It's probably the same for many of you in your countries, but certainly for English people, you can't go wrong with the weather as a quick topic of conversation just to make some small talk. So we often will make a little comment about the weather. Oh, it's hot, isn't it? Or, oh, it's very humid today. You know, that kind of thing. If it's humid, we use words like, it's a bit close today. It feels a bit close. Close means that it's, you know, the atmosphere is humid. It feels like somehow the atmosphere is very close to you. It's difficult to explain that. It feels a bit close. It's a bit sticky today, isn't it? Yeah, it's a bit sticky. It's very hot. Hope that we get some good weather this weekend. Might have a barbecue or something. All right, so a little bit of small talk about the weather there at the beginning, let's cut straight to the chase here. Let's get straight to the point here. Here is an episode about Brexit, the UK's referendum on the EU, the European Union, the EU. Finally, here it is. I've been mentioning this topic for a while, and so here it is. Brexit, you've seen it in the news, you've read it in the newspapers. The UK is having a referendum on membership of the European Union. And who knows, we might end up leaving. Just to be absolutely perfectly clear, the referendum means that the people of the UK will be able to basically vote whether they want to remain a part of the EU or leave the EU. OK, so it's a really big deal. And it could be a very, very big moment in the history of the UK and the history of the European Union and, to an extent, a history of the world, because it's a serious and significant moment. All right. This is all over the news and all over the internet in the UK at the moment. Everyone's talking about it, not just in the UK, all over Europe and probably around the world as well. You can't escape this subject, certainly in England at the moment. And it's going to get more and more intense the closer we get to the 23rd of June, which is the date of the referendum. I've had plenty of messages from listeners asking me to talk about this on the podcast, so here we go. Now, I've been wondering how to approach this topic for ages. It's actually a very complex issue, which I'd like to cover properly, taking into account the different arguments in some detail in order to hopefully bring some genuine insight to the issue. And I think that podcasting is the perfect medium for having a longer conversation in which we go into all the little details and stuff like that. Certainly with the issue of Brexit in the media, our emotions are being played upon all the time. There's a lot of emotional rhetoric going on, especially from the main political proponents of both campaigns. And it's either, on one side, it's either fear, like, for example, in the case of David Cameron, who recently suggested that a Brexit could lead to World War III. That's a very scary outcome. I mean, maybe he's got a point, but there's certainly a hell of a lot of fear being used there. So it's either fear on one hand, or it's kind of a patriotic nationalism on an almost ridiculous level in some cases. Like, for example, Boris Johnson, who recently compared the EU project to the project of Hitler during World War II. And he kind of made a comparison there, saying that basically the EU was like the same thing as what Hitler was doing, but it, with using slightly different methods, which is an outrageous thing to say, really. And, you know, Boris Johnson has said that, you know, by leaving the European Union, Britain could become the heroes of Europe. It's all very emotional, political rhetoric. But on Luke's English podcast, let's have a normal conversation about this, shall we? Now, I think there are several ways to deal with the Brexit subject on the podcast. For example, I could start with the vocabulary and the terminology of it, because there's a lot of very specific language involved in this subject. When you consider that the whole thing relates to issues like the economy, immigration, sovereignty, legislative procedure, social policies, the environment, security, and just the inner workings of the European institutions. It's all very complicated, and there's a lot of very specific, quite heavy language involved in it. So I could take a bottom-up approach, which means that I start with the terminology, start with the language of Brexit, and work up from there. Or I could go with a top-down approach and just sort of look at the subject as a whole and just basically talk about Brexit. In the end, I've decided to go with the latter, and that is basically to just jump right into the subject here in this first episode by having a conversation about Brexit. And who better to talk to than my dad, Rick? So this is the first thing that you will hear on the subject on Luke's English podcast. It's a conversation with my dad. So that's what you're going to hear first before I then expect to go into Brexit in a bit more detail in some later episodes, looking, for example, at some of the vocabulary of the subject. Now, what about my dad? You've probably heard my dad on this podcast before if you're a long-term Lepster. I thought it would be interesting for you, my listeners, to hear on this podcast a conversation between a well-informed, articulate, and intelligent man and his father. One final point here before we listen to the conversation. The day before I spoke to my dad for the podcast, I posted a question on social media saying this: my dad's going to be on the podcast talking about Brexit. Do you have any questions? I got loads of questions from interested Lepsters. Thank you very much if you wrote one of those questions. What I did was to consolidate all your queries and points into just a few simple questions, which I then used as the basis for this discussion. So I don't actually read out your questions specifically or mention any of the names, but thank you anyway for your questions. I think we managed to cover a lot of them in our conversation. Anything that we didn't deal with, I will probably come back later. I'll probably come back to those things later. All right, so without any further ado, let's now hear the conversation with my dad, Rick, about the UK's referendum on Europe and all that Brexit stuff. And here we go. All right, so I'm sitting here with my dad. Hello, Dad. How are you?
Hello, Luke. I'm absolutely fine. Nice to be here in Paris.
Yes, nice to have you back on the podcast as well. Are you having a nice weekend in Paris?
Yes, very good. We've actually had a little visit to Nancy, which is a town in the east of France, which is extremely beautiful and elegant, and it's in Alsace region, and it's somewhere we hadn't been before, so that's why we went, just to have a look at a Nancy, very nice, and then we're back in Paris and heading for home tomorrow.
Lots of English people like to go on holiday in France, don't they?
Yes, yes. Obviously, it's a very popular holiday destination, and not only that, a lot of British people in recent years have bought properties in France, particularly in northern France, Normandy, places like that, mm-hmm. where they can use them as holiday homes. They buy old farmhouses and get them all smartened up and use them as holiday homes. So it's a bit of a joke that Britain has bought half of France. And, of course, Britons are very good travellers, a bit like the Dutch. They're also the same. They travel around a lot. And British people like to go to Italy and they like to go to Spain. So, yes, we spend a lot of holiday time in mainland Europe.
Yeah. We are sitting, by the way, listeners, in the SkyPod. Did you know that this room is...
I did know it was the SkyPod, and certainly it is a SkyPod, at the top of the world here in Paris, with an amazing view.
That's right. Although the view is not very good today because it's pouring with rain. It's been bucketing it down all day, hasn't it? You know what, Dad? I'm going to open up the this blind, which is actually soaking wet. Can you see that?
Yes, it's been leaking because there's so much rain pouring down.
The blind is actually stuck to the window frame there.
I can see the Eiffel Tower now.
There you go.
Look at that.
A nice view of rainy Paris. So, listeners, you might be able to hear the sound of the rain landing on the top of the SkyPod, the roof of this room that we're in. So you might be able to hear that actual sound effects here in actual Paris. So it's two British blokes talking about the UK and the EU.
And about Brexit, which is the trendy word, which is British exit from the EU. So people are calling it Brexit. There was a time when they were talking about Grexit, when people were speculating that Greece might have to leave the Eurozone, but mm-hmm. of course they didn't. We'll see whether it's just a month away from our referendum now. A month's time, the British people will vote on whether they should leave the EU or remain in it. A simple question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a huge moment, isn't it, in British and European history?
Extremely significant. No country has ever left the EU. So it's uncharted territory, and nobody really knows how it would work if there was a vote to leave. All the treaties, all the legal entanglements would have to be readdressed. Relationships would have to be changed in terms of travel, visas. Mm-hmm. Working abroad, whether there would be obligations to stay with certain EU directives or not, what would be the relationship? So it would be a unique relationship. Mm. Obviously, there are other countries like Norway and Switzerland that are not actually in the EU, but they are very closely connected to it in being in the same trade agreement, and even in the Schengen zone for free travel. But nobody's left before, and so no one's really sure what would happen.
It's an extremely complicated situation, and I'm not entirely sure, Dad, if we are qualified to talk with great authority on the subject. Do we have any credentials to talk about this subject, do you think?
Well, I mean, no, it is a complicated subject, and I can't claim to be the world's greatest expert, but I have been a journalist for many years and dealing with international news and observing what they call the European project and its development for a long time. And it's part of your life, of course, in that if Britain actually joined the EEC, which became the European Union, they joined it just a few years before you were born. So you basically haven't known a time when we weren't in the EU. But I have, and I can remember, you know, the referendum which was held when we decided we were going to join, which was I think in 1973.
Prime Minister Edward Heath, known as Ted Heath. Anyway, so there was a referendum in 1973 We're pretty sure it's 1973.
Yes, I'm pretty sure
it
was.
For some reason, I got the date 1975 in my head as well.
But I'm pretty sure it was 73.
Anyway,
We did, you know, the majority was to join, and we joined. Mm-hmm. And ever since then, the relationship between Britain and the EU has been slightly Eurosceptic, slightly different from others. And it's difficult to say why exactly. I mean, that strip of water separating the British Isles from mainland Europe is you might not think it matters, but it does. It makes us just slightly separate, and our history, of course, has been one of being slightly independent of mainland Europe.
So there's so much to say, and it's such a complicated thing to talk about with so many different aspects to it. As you just mentioned there, there's obviously the history of the UK's relationship with Europe and the geographical nature of that relationship. You know, the UK is an island, and that does have an effect on the way that people think about Europe, like the way that the British feel about the European Union. And all sorts of things. I mean, we could go back into history and look at, for example, what happened during World War II and the fact that Britain was never invaded, and that sort of key moment in the creating sort of modern British identity, which is this, you know, this idea of Winston Churchill saying we will never surrender, you know, all that stuff. And I think that's kind of important to help to give context to the way British people feel about Europe to an extent. That the Brits do still feel like they are an island nation, and that part of that identity of modern Britain has come from that sense that we are slightly separate, and that perhaps some of our best moments have been when Britain has stood alone and stood proud and things like that. So that history helps us to understand, to an extent, why there is a different feeling or a slightly more sceptical feeling about the European project in the UK, but not for everyone.
No, I think it's quite right what you say. And the popular press in this country are very influential, and they've always played to this kind of nationalist spirit, you know, Britain, and they think it sells newspapers. But now, in terms of the Brexit debate, the press are pretty Eurosceptic, because they have been for a long time. They've always, you know, basically played this Great Britain card, and we don't need any help from any foreigners, populist stuff. And I think that has got into people's brains. And so you have irrational arguments about the benefits of being in the EU, but the anti-EU factions don't seem to worry about the rational arguments. They basically are talking about something more mysterious than that, something about just being British and we don't need anybody else.
Mm. I did put onto Facebook just yesterday a status with a question saying to my listeners, I'm going to talk to my dad about Brexit. Do you have any questions? And a number of questions arrived, lots of questions from listeners, and I've basically been able to summarize them in this way. So essentially the questions are like this. What is Brexit, first of all? Why has the Brexit question come up now? What are the main arguments for and against Brexit? What would be the consequences of it? And what do we think about it personally? And I know that my listeners are going to want to get opinions from us. And we'll probably come on to the personal opinions later, but we're going to attempt to deal with it in a detailed manner resorting to simple emotional arguments. We want to actually look at the real details here. Okay. It's going to be difficult, isn't it?
Well, we'll try not to be too boring about it. Okay, but you did get a lot of questions, didn't you?
Got loads of questions, yeah. We can't answer them all, ladies and gentlemen. But we will attempt to basically respond to the basic points that were asked.
It's interesting that there are so many people from different parts of the world have been firing in questions at you. So I would have thought that, you know, perhaps in Latin America or somewhere, people might not be particularly interested, but it seems they are.
Yeah. Do you think this is an important subject? I mean, you know, people might look at this and think, oh, it's just about the UK. But it's more important than that, isn't it?
I think it is. I think, obviously, the European Union is the biggest trading bloc in the world. You know, you can argue about China's purchasing power, but as a free trade zone, it's the biggest one, with 500 million people. And, of course, it's a very influential body. The EU is, you know, a democratic union of 28 nation states. It's actually a very significant union. And the fear is, I mean, and the people who are in other parts of the EU, is that if Britain leaves, it will undermine the whole future of the project. And it may encourage other nationalist movements in other countries. And it may mean the end of the development of the EU project and start of its kind of disintegration. But the other thing is, of course, they feel that Britain is an important member of the EU. It's one of the biggest countries, one of the biggest contributors, not only financially, but also to all the programmes. It is very involved in the EU. And so there is a feeling that this would be a retrograde step. I'm talking about feeling in other countries, and many of the leaders of other countries, Germany, France, Italy, have all spoken up and said it would be really bad news for them if Britain left.
So because the UK is such a big player in Europe, if we left, it could seriously sort of affect the EU. And since the EU is so significant in the world, that would have knock-on effects all around the world. And, you know, the way that in this globalised world, everyone's interconnected. So if the EU suddenly was rocked by a big change, then that's going to affect everyone, isn't it?
Yes, and if anyone who studies economics will know how important confidence is.
Yeah.
This mysterious thing called confidence. And obviously, if markets start being rocked by uncertainty, doubt, lack of confidence, it means lack of investment. It means that there isn't a pattern of confident investment leading to growth. And a lot of companies that are involved in Britain and other parts of the world would have to start considering whether they should, perhaps, if you're a car maker like BMW, making lots of cars in Britain, you might look at the new landscape and say, well, we ought to pull out of Britain and build our cars in Spain or somewhere else. Nobody really knows, but it might have lots of disruptive effects, which would affect big business and might affect people's personal travel and other aspects of their lives. Mm.
Why did the referendum happen then, Dad? Why now, after this amount of time? Why are we having a referendum now?
That's a very good question. I mean, we shouldn't forget that this is politics. That a year ago in Britain, there was a general election. And David Cameron had been the Prime Minister, but leading a coalition, which is unusual for our country, with the Liberal Democrats. As the election approached, there was a lot of support for the party, relatively new party, called UKIP, which stands for the United Kingdom Independence Party. And they basically had one policy, which was leave the European Union. And the reason, they said, was because we couldn't control immigration if we didn't leave the European Union. And this was attracting a lot of popular support, so much so that the right-of-centre Conservative Party was getting pretty nervous about them. And so during the campaign, David Cameron announced that there would be a referendum. He would renegotiate our terms of being members of the European Union to get rid of some of the worst aspects that worried people. And then he would put the result to a referendum, definitely by the end of 2017. And that was an election promise. Now, so that's why we're doing it. But of course, as it turned out, UKIP didn't damaged the Conservative Party very much in the election. They only got one MP elected.
But I think part of that, Dad, is because, okay, so David Cameron had a plan, or the Conservatives had a plan, I think, which was, first of all, win the election, get a majority government so that the Conservatives weren't in coalition with the Liberal Democrats anymore, so they would have a majority government. Plan number one. Second plan, renegotiate the Britain's membership of the European Union. Step three, have a referendum. Step four, get a Remain result, and then just carry on.
That's
okay?
Right.
So David Cameron, the Prime Minister, is in favour of staying in the Union, right? So Okay, let me just go back and clarify that because it's a bit complicated. So we go back to, let's say, 2012 or something, just before the previous election. And UKIP are on the rise. This is, as you said, this is this party who are primarily focused on getting the UK out of the European Union as a simple solution to all of our problems. The problems being mainly immigration. Too many immigrants. Everything. You know, your bus is late. Immigrants. You know, you can't get a job. Immigrants. England haven't won the World Cup since 1966. Immigrants. Right. So UKIP were this party getting more and more popularity, and this was a threat to the Conservatives. And so the Conservatives thought, right, what are we going to do? I know, to win the election, we will put a referendum on the agenda, right? So they promised the people, if you vote for the Conservatives, you'll be voting for the choice to have your say on EU membership. And naturally, lots of Eurosceptics who might have voted UKIP in the election voted for the Tories because they wanted a chance to vote in the referendum. Okay, and what happened then is that the election happened last year and UKIP didn't get many seats. They only ended up with one seat. Now, that's partly because of our electoral system, but also I think because people chose to vote Conservative because they wanted this referendum. So a lot of the Eurosceptics voted Tory in order to get the referendum. As a result, well, it's complicated, but partly as a result, the Conservatives got majority government, right?
That's right. They got a clear majority. And the evidence shows that quite a lot of former Labour voters were the people who were being attracted to UKIP as opposed to Conservative voters. So Labour didn't do very well. Conservative ploy to make sure that anybody tempted to vote UKIP would vote for them because they'd get a referendum guaranteed. And it seemed to have worked. The trouble was that David Cameron didn't really believe in leaving the EU, and he had to then go through this negotiated new relationship, which anybody who knows anything about the EU knows that you either play by the rules or you don't. So, and the idea of a completely new relationship was never a very persuasive argument. But he went round and he came up with some new ideas and claimed victory and then campaigned vigorously for us to stay in.
So that was step two of his plan. So step one, get the win the election and get majority government. Step two then was announced the referendum like he promised. Okay, he said there will be a referendum. He didn't announce the date first, but he said there would be one. And then step three is go to Europe, go to Brussels, and visit all of the different leaders and renegotiate Britain's membership. So I think the idea there was that he would show the public, and specifically show the Eurosceptics in UKIP and Eurosceptics in his own party, that he was trying to fix Britain's relationship with the European Union. And then he would be able to present to the public a choice, which was you vote to stay in with renegotiated terms or you vote out. And I think he did that because he wanted us to stay in.
Oh, absolutely.
And so he needed to show that he was taking a strong position on Europe. And so voting remain was the better of the two choices, you know?
Yeah, so that's where we are now. The fact is that a lot of independent voices are speaking up for us to remain in the EU, notably Barack Obama, who visited the UK quite recently and is an extremely persuasive orator. And he was very persuasive in saying why, as far as the United States was concerned, they would be very much in favour of EU remaining.
What did he say? He was like, the people of Britain, people of Britain need to go on holiday. They want to eat cheese. And something like
no,
that.
No, he didn't say that. Though it does sound a bit like it, Luke, I have to confess. His main point was about trade, and there was a lot of talk about this big EU-US trade deal, which has been, they've been negotiating it now for 2 years, and it's going to take another 2 years. And it's quite controversial. Listeners may have heard of the TTIP. It is supposed to produce the biggest ever global free trade agreement between all of the EU and the United States. And obviously there are voices who are worried about aspects of it, and we're not going to get into that. But he was in Europe basically promoting the TTIP, And talking about that, he was basically saying that if Britain leaves the EU, they're talking about negotiating their new terms with countries like the United States. He says, well, we're too busy negotiating with the EU. You would be at the back of the queue
right.
in negotiating a trade deal with the US.
That's complicated. That's about trade deals and things. So what we need to do now, it's so easy for this whole subject to get out of control and get too complicated. I think we understand the situation then. So we're now in a position where we've got a month left and various people have been campaigning for a Remain vote. So there's two camps. There's two camps, right?
Yeah.
Campaigns, two campaigns. One campaign is leave, vote leave. The other campaign is vote Remain, okay? The vote leave campaign, these are the people who want us to leave. And they are very vocal and very passionate, in fact. They're the ones who seem to have the loudest voices. They're the ones who seem to be dominating the media. And we get people such as Nigel Farage, the leader of UKIP. We also have, famously, Boris Johnson, the former mayor of London. He's probably the most outspoken voice for the Leave campaign. Boris now is travelling the country in a bus, which is called the Battle Bus. I don't like the name Battle. Why is it called the Battle Bus?
I think these campaign buses in Britain are always called the Battle Bus.
Okay, so he's battling for Britain to leave, basically. Yes. All right. So he's, you know, travelling around, campaigning, hitting the streets, and, you know, talking to the public, trying to persuade everyone to leave. Now, of course, there are arguments to say that everyone has their own personal reasons and their own vested interests in both arguments. What do you think? What do you think, Dad? Do you think we should leave or do you think we should remain?
Well, I can, you know, tell your listeners that I'm not entirely impartial on this subject because I do have quite strong views on it. I think it would be a disaster for Britain to leave the European Union. Nobody is really in this campaign speaking up for the many benefits that we get from being members of the EU. The pro campaign tends to concentrate on what they call Project Fear, which is all the terrible things that would happen if we left. But it would be a great advantage, I think, to a lot of people to hear a little bit more about the advantages of being in the EU, and there are many of them. And I personally think that going into isolation in a globalised world would be nuts.
Mm, yeah. Yeah. I mean, my listeners will be thinking, what does Luke think as well? Well, it shouldn't be a surprise that I also think we should stay in the European Union. And I agree with you, Dad. Now, what I'd like to do at this point is try and go through a few main points as a way of looking at sort of the arguments, the main arguments.
And these are taken from the questions that people fired into you in the last 24 hours.
Yeah, the main thrust of those questions seem to be, you know, what are the main arguments for the UK to stay, and what are the main arguments for the UK to leave? What would be the consequences on people and, you know, the whole situation? And what do you think personally? All right. Now, because I want balance as well, I want to understand the reasons why people think we should leave. I don't want to just dismiss those arguments because people feel very strongly about that. And I think that they must have some fairly good points. And they must do. I mean, I don't agree, but there must be some thinking behind that, of course. So I'd like to, you know, be respectful towards the Leave campaign.
Of course, we can relay what they're saying. I mean, they're being quoted every day in the newspapers, on the radio, on the TV. So we know what they're saying, and it's quite easy to summarise that, you know, for people listening in.
I've got an idea, right? What we can do is, to an extent, I can play devil's advocate here.
Okay.
What do you think?
Okay.
So that means that I'm going to sort of voice the arguments for leaving.
Okay.
And then you can kind of respond to those
well,
things.
Well, I'll try.
All right. So, you know, just to be clear, I think we should remain, and I pretty much agree with my dad, but just for the benefit of the argument, I'm going to try and sort of be the voice of the Leave campaign. And we'll go through a few different topics, okay?
Okay.
So we're going to start with the membership fee.
All right.
So this is where I am now, Boris Johnson or Nigel Farage or something. So the UK currently spends about £13 billion Well, last year we spent £13 billion on the EU. Fair enough, we received £4.5 billion of spending, EU spending in return. That's where they spent, you know, money on various projects in the UK. But on balance, we spent, you know, net. Our net contribution was £8.5 billion. And if we left, we would obviously make a huge saving by not having to spend that money. So if we left, we would save on our membership fee. We'd save, you know, £8.5 billion. So it'd save us money from the beginning, and we could use that money to spend it on very important things in the UK. Why are we giving our money to Europe? We should spend it on British people.
Well, I obviously would respond to that by saying that these figures are extremely crude figures. And even though 8.5 billion annual contribution, or if you like, 10 billion euros, sounds like a huge amount of money, it is a tiny amount compared with the annual GDP of the United Kingdom. I think it's less than half of 1%. And so it is, and it is about 7% of what we spend each year on our health service alone. It is not a huge amount. And if you're going to be a member of this union, obviously the more affluent countries are net contributors, and the poorer countries that are bringing their economies up to speed are not, and that's only right. But I think that if you're a member of any organisation, you get benefits for your membership fee. And the benefits are difficult to quantify, but we have lots and lots of benefits for being members of the EU in terms of collaboration on anti-terrorism or defence, in terms of environmental standards, in terms of the free trade, which, of course, is very difficult to measure. If we weren't in the free trade agreement, it would cost us a lot more than 10 billion euros a year to be able to trade in that kind of way. There are many, many other benefits. I'm particularly interested in scientific research, where the European Union does coordinate lots of big research programs. They have a very well-funded European research program, ranging from laboratories trying to find new antibiotics to the chemical analysis which tells you whether goods are safe or whether they're not. And the European Union has been global leaders in making sure you eliminate dangerous items from the goods that we use. There's many, many advantages we get which you can't actually put a price on.
Right. Okay. Well, then maybe we can go into a few of those areas where perhaps, as you argue, there may be an advantage for us being in, even if it costs us some money. We probably get lots of money back and other, as you said, things that we can't put a value on.
It's a complicated thing. I mean, if you talk about farm subsidies alone, it's very difficult to come up with a net figure of how much our farmers gain from being part of the common agricultural policy.
Yeah.
But also we have cohesion funds and we have projects. The charities, big charities, Oxfam in the United Kingdom, reckon that by bidding to the European Union for funds to do certain projects, it gives them about £30 million a year from the EU to help fund their projects.
Well, the EU gives £30 million
so
to...
So the charities are bidding for project money and getting it. Even the British Museum gets £3.5 million a year from the EU. So it's difficult to know what figures are counted in and what figures are counted out. But one thing is for sure, if you're not in the EU, you don't have access to structural funds, cohesion funds or regional funds.
Okay. Okay. Strong argument. Okay, let's talk a little bit about trade, if you don't mind. Do you want to talk about trade?
If you like.
So, okay, now the Leave campaigners... we'll say that it's about regulations, okay? So trading regulations. So the Leave campaign say that it's unfair on British businesses because they have these big books of regulations which they have to follow, and the regulations are ridiculous and complicated, and they don't sort of match the our interests. Like, for example, the example that's always made is that there are all these regulations about the curvature of bananas, and that you're not allowed to sell bananas that are curved in the wrong way, and it's ridiculous, and it's there are too many rules, and you know the Leave campaign want Britain to be free of these rules so that we can just go about our business without having to worry about complying with, you know, all these different rules and things. So leaving the EU would allow British business owners to just be able to run their businesses without interference from Brussels.
Yes, it is, you know, one of the arguments for leave. There's too much what we call red tape. It's a slang expression which basically means bureaucracy, because it goes back to the old days when lots of documents and regulations were literally tied up with red tape, and that term still exists for bureaucracy. So this says too much red tape. Now, this is a classic kind of right-wing business agenda. Businesses don't want regulation. Businesses are not interested in regulation, and they want the American model, which they see as being free of any kind of regulation. But of course, the EU is defending the citizens. That's what it is. It's difficult to explain the EU to some people. It's not a government with an opposition. It's actually representing the citizens, and it's trying to produce the best environment for us to live in, the best conditions for our prosperity, and the best security for its citizens. So businesses sometimes feel that it's just getting in the way. The popular press finds it very difficult to come up with specific examples that make sense. The famous, you know, bent bananas or straight bananas or whatever, it was only a popular press story because the European Union was trying to get a standard across all 28 member states of what are grade A vegetables and grade A fruit, so that, and what is grade B. And so, you know, the popular press leapt on that and saying, oh, they say we can't sell bent bananas. I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous. On the other hand, we are now in a position where just recently our roaming charges on mobile phones across the whole of Europe, the costs have come crashing down because of a long negotiation with the phone companies carried out by the EU, and they have basically forced them to stop these rip-off charges, and next year there won't be any roaming charges at all. If you're anywhere in the EU, it'll be just the same as if you're in your own country.
So basically your response to the argument about regulations is that those regulations are actually for the good of the people.
There are very few regulations that the Brexit camp can flaunt as an example and say, look at this bad regulation. They have come up with hardly anything that is bad for you.
So in fact, regulations are good because they protect
the consumers.
Right. And as you said, an example of that is the roaming charges. This is mobile phone companies that would like to charge us extra when we travel to Europe. So, for example, when you come to France and you bring your phone with you, the phone company wants to charge you double or something.
Just the same as if I was in Brazil.
Yeah, they want to charge you like expensive charges for using your telephone here. But what the European Union is doing is attempting to prevent the companies from charging.
Well, they've succeeded. The deal is done in two phases. The first phase, big reduction in the charges, which has just happened. And the next phase next year will be no roaming charges at all across the 28 member states.
So a benefit then of EU regulation is that it's much cheaper to use your phone in the European Union.
Yeah, and other regulations are about, you know, clean water and clean air and all sorts of other things, which if you try and do it at a national basis, it doesn't make sense. A lot of things have to be handled pan-nationally. There's not much point in trying to have an environmental policy if the country next door has a different one.
I'm supposed to be arguing for the Leave campaign, aren't I?
Yes, but go on, try again.
But bent bananas though, bananas. Bloody bureaucrats in Brussels and bananas. Why are they writing laws about bananas? It's ridiculous. They're just faceless bureaucrats.
I'll help you out here. I have to say that there are one or two areas where I think the EU is a bit bureaucratic.
Yes.
I do think so. And I mean, I sometimes go and, you know, work in Brussels and I meet people who are involved in programs which I think are maybe a bit extravagant, maybe a bit of a waste of time. And when you look at all these big shiny buildings and they've bureaucrats driving around in their big shiny cars, you do sometimes wonder whether they have actually been in touch with a Europe affected by a long-running recession. And we've had countries like Spain with 40% unemployment, Greece still struggling to get back on its feet after its, you know, huge debts and the banks collapsed. We've had a lot of, you know, pain out there. And you feel that maybe the European Union has been insulated from that and it could be leaner and more efficient and more focused. And I think there's a lot of people who would say that would be a good thing, not just in Britain, in many other EU countries. But the way to achieve it is to be in there and make it happen. Walking away isn't going to do any good at all.
So the point there is that, OK, the European Union as an administrative organization is very complicated and there is a lot of bureaucracy and it's insanely complex, but that's not necessarily a reason for us to just leave. We should try and, you know, understand it and try and be in the driving seat of Europe, right?
Yes, I think that's right. I think, you know, you've got to be in it to improve it.
You have to be in it to win it.
You have to be. But it's true that a lot of people find it very complex. And during this campaign, it's become evident that many, many people in Britain really know very little about the EU. I mean, it's spectacular. The surveys have shown that people don't know which states are member states. They don't know how it works. And I think that's probably a failure of the media, as well as being a bit of a failure of the administration, that it's a great pity that in other European countries people are interested in the European Parliament, which now has substantial powers. They know who their members of the European Parliament are. In our country, we don't know who they are. Mm. And most people don't even know that, you know, the three institutions, how they work together: the Council of Ministers, which is the member states, the Commission, which is kind of the driving force, and the civil service, and the directly elected Parliament. How these three work together to agree on legislation, or agree on regulations, or agree on policies that they voluntarily sign up to.
You know what's a problem with this whole thing is that it is confusing. There's no way around it. I mean, I was just listening to you there, and to be honest, I'm confused. Whenever anyone talks about EU institutions, I get really confused and I get fed up, right? Now, but again, that's not really a reason for us to leave. Just because it's confusing doesn't mean it's necessarily bad for us. Now, another argument for the Leave campaign, they say that the European Union is an undemocratic arrangement, right? So it's about sovereignty. Sovereignty is one of the big things. In fact, you could say it's mainly about sovereignty, about immigration, and perhaps about the economy. But sovereignty seems to be one of the big things. And when we talk about sovereignty, we mean Britain's independence to govern itself. And people say, the Brexiteers say that the European Union is undemocratic, and that is bad for Britain's sovereignty. Is the EU undemocratic?
Well, I think that the EU is very open. It's a model of openness in that all the committees, all the decisions are posted online, and most of them are open to the media and so on. Unlike in London, where a lot of the work behind the scenes is not open. But the institutions are these three institutions I mentioned. One is the member states, which is all the elected parliaments coming together to agree things. So if you believe your government is democratically elected, they are your representatives there.
Are they? Are they democratically elected?
The Council of Ministers are, yes, indeed.
Yeah. Yep.
You know, like the prime ministers get together for what we call a European summit. They've all been elected. So they're representing their own countries at that forum. So that's a democratic institution. The second one, the European Parliament, is obviously a big directly elected body of people who represent their part of Europe, their region of Europe.
Mm-hmm.
The third bit isn't.
Right.
This is the Commission, but it's like a civil service. You don't elect your civil service either.
Yeah.
And it gives you some continuity, and they are supposed to bring forward legislation which the member states want, negotiate an agreement which is acceptable to everybody and get it through the Parliament.
So just let me just clarify that. There are three parts to the European Union, let's say, in a fairly simplistic way. You've got the European Parliament, and that's basically members of Parliament from each member state that have been elected within the member states, and they go and they represent their countries.
They represent a region within their country.
Right.
There are 731 of them.
Okay, 731 members of the European Parliament.
Correct.
Many of our MEPs are Eurosceptics, which is interesting, that it seems people who are engaged in European politics in the UK are the ones who want us to be out. That's why they're engaged in it. They're the ones that lead the agenda. They lead the conversation on Europe because they're passionate against it. Everyone else is like, well, it's fine. It seems to be all right. The only ones who are going on about it seem to be the ones who don't like it.
Well, there's not a majority of Eurosceptic MEPs from our country, but there's certainly a significant number.
The vocal ones.
And they say, oh, it's all awful. Vote for me and I'll sort it out, and so on and so on. And that's quite attractive for a campaign where people don't really understand what the issues are and how they are relevant to them.
The point was that, okay, you've got the European Parliament and it's made up of elected representatives. Fine. Then there's the European Council. Who's in the EU Council?
The Council is the way the nation states coming together is described.
Okay.
So a European Council with a capital E and a capital C is where the leaders of the countries come together in a summit. And we call it a summit. They call it the European Council. But in between those summits, there are meetings of the ministers, the Council of Ministers meetings, and that's within the broad umbrella of the Council. So when all the foreign ministers get together, that's the Foreign Ministers' Council. The Environment Ministers get together, that's the Environment Council. So the ministers of different portfolios meet together in council meetings, and then when the leaders all meet, it's called the summit.
So
the council is where the member states come together to collaborate, to share knowledge, and to agree joint actions.
That's right. That's the council. That's when the leaders get together.
In my opinion, it's the most powerful part of the three parts of the power block of this triangle of power in the EU.
I'm just trying to...
If the member states meeting in council, if the member states don't want something to happen, it doesn't happen.
So I'm just still trying to understand what the council is, but you have explained it. I'm now clarifying it, right? So basically, the council is when the leaders of all the countries get together for a meeting.
Yes, it's when they meet maybe in the Agriculture Council or the Fisheries Council, but it's when the member states come together formally in what is called a council meeting.
Just a yes or no answer, right? For this little section, just give me yes or no answers, okay? So European Council, that would be, for example, when David Cameron goes and meets other leaders and they talk about European stuff.
Yes, that's the... actual council.
Yes or no answer.
Yes, that's the summit. Yes,
all right. That's the summit, which happens every year. Okay.
Oh, they happen more often than that. Every 2 or 3 months.
Okay. Summit. And then there's also meetings that come under the bracket of the European Council.
Ministerial level.
For example, the Minister for the Environment from every single member state, they get together and they talk about environmental stuff.
Yes.
So those people are democratically elected.
Yes.
Because they've been elected within their home countries.
Yes.
Okay. So that's European Parliament, democratically elected. European Council, democratically elected people. Then there's the European Commission. You said they're basically like the civil service. They're the office workers of the whole thing, right?
Yes, it's not quite a civil service because it is more political. And the parties, party blocks in the Parliament, put forward their candidates to be the head of the Commission. And Jean-Claude Juncker emerged as being the head of the Commission this time around. But it's not an entirely democratic process. It is they tried to meet the complaints that the Commission isn't very democratic by using that mechanism. I wasn't terribly convinced. And I don't think it matters much. I think you do want a good professional who knows what he's doing, who's supported by the member states, to lead the Commission, which is, yes, the civil service, but it also has more political power, and it puts forward legislation and it tries to negotiate deals.
Okay, so the Commission is not entirely completely democratic, the Commission. But as you said before, just like any government, for example, the government in the UK's government in Westminster, that has many people, the civil service, who are not democratically elected. For example, the permanent secretary to the prime minister,
no,
he or she, I don't even know who it is not democratically elected. And plenty of other civil servants who do government work, they're not elected. So any government is made up of elected and unelected representatives. So the point here is that argument, which is the EU is an undemocratic thing, which is destroying the sovereignty of the member states, it's not really a fair argument.
I don't think it's a fair argument. It's one that is wheeled out a lot by the Brexiteers. You know, who are these people telling us what to do? And they talk about having supremacy of the British Parliament over European law. That's also slightly misunderstood, if you like, because a lot of the European law is agreed in advance in the council meetings, and it won't get put forward and get through the parliament unless it is actually agreed. And most of these things don't affect Britain very much because they are often bringing up all the 28 member states to a certain level, a certain standard. So let's say something simple like water quality. You've got to reach this level of water quality by this certain date. That's a regulation. Well, you'll find that in a lot of countries, they've already reached it. So it doesn't actually apply. In other cases, yes, there are targets that you can strive to reach. In our case, in Britain, where we have a lot of beaches, the beaches have met European standards, and it required quite a long time. To get the sewage systems changed and to get water treatment plants introduced so that they would meet the European standards. And these targets and timescales are actually quite useful for governments to say, well, we've got to do this because Brussels says so.
Can I just make a point here? Listeners, did you notice that? My dad just mentioned that we have a lot of beaches in the UK. We do. We have beaches in the UK. Not the place that you would imagine for a beach holiday, perhaps, but we do. And they're cleaner now than they used to be.
Much.
They're much, much cleaner now. I mean, our beaches, some of them used to be a little bit dirty, and you know, the quality of the water and the cleanliness of the sand and stuff was not great in the 70s, and now most of our beaches are clean and pleasant places to spend time. They might not be the hottest, sunniest places, but they're clean, and there's, you know, they're nicer than they were.
The point I'm making is that a lot of the argument from the people who say we are told what to do by Brussels is actually not entirely true, that all the regulations are agreed by the member states, and a lot of these regulations are things that don't particularly apply to Britain. So you could say, for example, there's a regulation about the size of a pen that you can keep a pig in when it's having piglets.
Wait, when you keep a pig in a pen?
Yeah, indoors, in a shed.
Not in a pen that you write with.
No, not a pen you write with. A kind of, we call it a pig sty, a sort of metal crate.
It's like a house for a pig.
And the, you know, after a lot of arguments with the farmers and everything else, you say this is the European standard, which is, you know, fair and doesn't stress the pig out and blah, blah, blah.
You don't want stressed out
and
pigs.
So, you know, you don't. So you might say that's our European standard for bringing up, you know, pigs. And they're looking at countries which haven't traditionally had that standard. I mean, let's name names. We're talking about countries like Romania, and we're talking about other countries that haven't had the same standard. So bringing everybody up to standard is one of the things that the legislation does, and it is actually normally good.
Right, so basically, the European Union is right about a lot of these things. Okay. Trade. Can I just say something about trade?
We're going along for a long time here.
I know, but there's just so many things to cover. I don't want my listeners to feel like we haven't done it properly. But you know, listeners, ladies and gentlemen, if we talk about Brexit, it's impossible to talk about this subject in a clear way in a short amount of time. It's just not possible.
I tell you what we ought to do.
Yeah.
The Remain camp have pretty much won the economy argument. They've got the governor of the Bank of England, the IMF, lots of world leaders, other people saying it would be economically really bad for Britain if we left. So I think they pretty much won the economic argument. But the other one about immigration, they haven't really won. The Brexiteers say we must take control of our borders. Immigration is out of control. Lots and lots of Europeans have come in and taken jobs, and they put pressure on our housing. We have a housing crisis.
We don't have
enough shortage of houses. And they put pressure on our National Health Service. There's a bit of a crisis there too, because the health service is in deeply in debt. Not the only country in Europe to be in that condition. So they are still talking about we must take control of our borders and stop this uncontrolled immigration. So we ought to have a quick word about that.
Immigration. Oh, my God. Really? it's such a controversial subject, immigration.
It is a controversial subject. I think it's, again, it's head over heart. If you ask how many people have directly been affected by, you know, immigration badly, it's difficult to find too many people who've been directly affected.
I can say some things about immigration, okay? So, first of all, economics, the economics of immigration. Now, actually, I think it's fair to say that immigration actually helps the economy. Why? Because it provides the country with people who are willing to work for less money, right?
It's not quite as simple as that.
Isn't it?
There's been two very good independent analysis in Britain recently about immigration, and they've compared outside EU immigration with immigration for the EU, free movement of people within the EU. They've both said it's been particularly good for the economy. The people coming in from the EU have been young people. They've been working hard. They've been paying their taxes. They are not a particular burden on the health service. Whereas people from outside the EU, such as from India, have not been quite the same kind of demographic. The other thing is that in long term, we have an aging population. And the proportion of people who are working and contributing to the economy against the proportion of people who are retired is changing really quite quickly. And the economists are saying we need immigration of younger people to keep the workforce healthy and to keep the income from tax receipts healthy. You've got to remember that in our country, we have very low unemployment. We have almost record low unemployment. We have more people in work now than ever before recorded. And our unemployment level is somewhere around 5%, which is just about as low as it can get. So we don't have a crisis of immigrants, you know, taking jobs and leaving people jobless.
Really? Because that's what the Brexiteers say. They say these immigrants coming over here, taking our jobs, you know, should have British people for British jobs. That's what they say.
They say that, but the evidence is completely against it. That there is no shortage of jobs. There are lots. There's a skills shortage. The business people complain bitterly that they have lots and lots of jobs they can't fill because they don't have people with enough skills. And at the other end of the scale, like the agricultural workers in eastern England, lots and lots of Poles and Latvians and other East Europeans have come in to do the agricultural jobs because they couldn't get anybody to do them. And you know, there's lots of evidence that the people who are involved in farming in East Anglia, as it's called, said we don't know what we'd do if we didn't have the immigrants to do the harvests and plant the potatoes or whatever.
I reckon it's a response to a feeling of dissatisfaction that many people have. I'm talking on sort of about the people who think that there's too much immigration. I think it's a part of a sense that our culture is changing. They don't like the idea that new people are coming in and they don't sort of contribute to our culture and that we're losing our culture. They see it in that sense. But, you know, things always change, don't they?
Yes, I think that if you're a historian and you look back at this in a few years' time and you try to analyse what's been going on, you can see that there is a general pattern that if you have a big recession, if you have an economic crisis, then almost inevitably it leads to a rise of right-wing nationalism because, you know, human beings are tribal, and you fall back on your tribe, and you blame the incomers and you blame the foreigners when you're in a difficult economic situation. That's always been the case. And the big crash of 2007 and 2008 has inevitably led to a rise of nationalism in all sorts of parts of Europe. So in Austria, we get a party saying, put Austria first, and they're becoming popular. It's just one of those things that happens. You have to stay rational and look at the evidence. And in the UK, the evidence, all the evidence is that we are not suffering from immigration from the EU.
So in times of crisis, it seems that people want a solution. They need a scapegoat. They need to see who's responsible for... And it's like, in a crisis, people are, I feel bad. Whose fault is it? And it's complicated, the answers to why people feel bad and they feel scared in a crisis. It's very easy, too easy, to point at the other person and say, it's because of immigrants. You know, it's because of these people that I don't know coming into my town and sort of giving me a sense that my culture is under threat, my job's under threat. You know, I feel bad and I don't know why. It's too easy to blame the sort of the foreigner, you know. I think that's part of it. I think that's part of it.
I think it is. You hear people saying that. You know, they say, I was on the tube on the underground the other day, and guess what? I never heard anyone speaking English. Like, it's kind of shocking.
Why is that bad?
And you say, well, so what? London is a multicultural city. What's the problem?
Yeah. Then there's the question of terrorism, right? Here's another argument, Dad. People say, well, the European Union... Because of the free movement of people within the Union, this is a vehicle in which terrorists can come in. So people are scared that the free movement of people will allow terrorists to move through the Union, and that you know extremists are coming into the country under the umbrella of the European Union.
Well, I think it's a terrible argument. I mean, this is an argument that the people who want to leave the EU haven't won. And in the campaign, we've had a whole number of real experts from the military and from the security services and others all saying being within the EU, sharing intelligence with them and working out, you know, joint strategies is much more, gives us much more security than if we weren't at the table. Of course, Britain is not in the Schengen area. And your listeners will probably know that the Schengen area of Europe is all the countries that don't have borders. And you can drive your truck from Spain to Italy without stopping. You know, it's a borderless zone, the Schengen zone. Britain and Ireland are not in the Schengen zone. There's a small group of countries not in the Schengen zone, and we are not in it. So that's why we still have passport control when people... You know, come in from France or Belgium or wherever, we still have that. So the idea that leaving the EU would make us more secure is simply not the case. In fact, it would be probably more difficult for us to have that control. There is a lot of immigrants, mainly Africans, who are trying to get into Britain, who finish up at Calais on the northern French coast, where they sit in a camp because they can't get across. And that's because the French don't let them get on the ferries or get them on the trains. Yeah, if we weren't part of the EU, why would the French bother? They would say, right, get on the trains. Yeah. It's nothing to do with us anymore.
So in fact, the EU holds on to people. The EU actually prevents many people coming into the UK at this point.
Yes, it's an agreement. You know, we work together. Mm. And I don't see how you could possibly argue that being outside the EU would make you more secure. We need to share information and we need to work together on this big issue of security against terrorism. And it's connected, of course, with immigration from the Middle East.
François Hollande said... that if the UK left the European Union, there would be consequences. Perhaps what he means is that the immigrants who are being held in a camp in Calais would be sort of they might let them go. They might let them just travel over the channel into
they
England.
Might. We don't know what the famous consequences would be, but it's quite clear that there would be consequences if we leave the EU, many of them extremely complicated. We don't quite know what would happen.
I think that illegal immigration would rise if we left the European Union, because there wouldn't be a system in place to, you know...
Well, why would countries like the Netherlands and Belgium and others, why would they fall over themselves to help us if we're not part of the Union? And they have to look after themselves, but they are very European, particularly European countries, those two I mentioned, and they believe in solidarity and they believe in working together. So I don't think they would have the same attitude to Britain if we said we're leaving the EU. They would feel no responsibility for our problems.
One more point here. You know, this argument that the European Union allows terrorists to kind of come in. Well, if you remember the terrorist attacks of July 2007, okay, that was when sort of extremists bombed the London Underground and a bus in central London. I remember the day very well. Though those extremists didn't come through the EU, they didn't travel all the way from Syria through the EU or anything like that. They were born and they grew up in England.
Yes, they were homegrown terrorists, as we call them.
So it's
radicalized. You know,
the EU is not necessarily a gateway for terrorists. The terrorists, you know, might just arrive from within the country. So it's not about terrorism. In fact, as you mentioned, when we're members of the EU, we can collaborate with the EU in terms of intelligence and security services, and it would be a much more effective system for monitoring and preventing terrorism. And if we didn't collaborate with the EU, then it would be much, much harder for us to collect intelligence on people that we don't want in our country.
That's right. How long have we been talking?
Well, I can
your
see
poor
here.
Listeners will probably be completely fast asleep now. Have we gone past the hour?
Yeah, we've done an hour and 5 minutes.
Well, you're going to have to return to this subject. As we record this, it's just a month away to the referendum. And at the moment, the opinion polls are showing that Remain is gained a bit of ground, mm-hmm. particularly since, I think, Barack Obama's intervention. And the Brexiteers are just a bit behind in the polls. But personally, I think you have to watch out. There's still a month to go, and the polls in the past have been wrong. And
That's the opinion polls,
not
the Polish people.
And it's still very close. And I still think it's entirely possible that on June the 23rd, we might vote to leave the EU.
Really?
Astonishing as it may seem. So I think that you should return to this subject after 2 or 3 weeks and see, we're using someone else with their opinions, where we are with not many days to go.
Yeah, because, you know, I always want my episodes of this podcast to be easy, you know, clear and entertaining and fun and motivating to listen to. And I understand that Brexit is such a big subject and many people are interested in it, but it's hard for me to deal with the subject in the way that I would like to deal with it, you know, to make it light and fun and, you know, easily accessible. Just whenever you start talking about the subject, it just gets heavy.
Well, we've done our best, Luke, and it is a complicated and serious subject. And of course, I'm sure a lot of your listeners will disagree with me because I think that we should stay. Obviously, there's plenty of people who believe we'll be much better off on our own. I just don't think it's been thought through.
We'll see. Only history can tell, only time can tell what will happen. Dad, thanks so much for kind of talking to me about this, because I know
it's a tough subject.
It is a tough subject. So I appreciate you sort of taking the time to talk to me about it. Thank you. I'm sure that my listeners also will appreciate the fact that you've taken time out to talk to them on Luke's English podcast today. I'll be coming back to the subject and we'll be looking at things like language and some of those things in a slightly clearer, hopefully, way in the future. Thanks very much for listening, everyone. And thanks, Dad.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Okay, so there you go. I said there at the end of that chat that it's all a bit complicated. And while recording that interview, I was thinking that it was bound to be a bit difficult to follow. I wonder if you managed to follow all of that, okay? Did you? Actually, after listening back to the conversation,
I think that generally we managed to deal with it in a fairly clear way, especially my dad, who is very articulate and very well informed on the subject. But I wonder how it was for you. Now, I have a variety of listeners to this podcast with varying levels of knowledge and varying levels of English as well. So I'm sure that some of you followed the conversation without too many problems, whereas others might have been a bit lost at times. If you were a little bit lost at times and you continued and you kept listening and you've got to this point, then well done. Good job. You've been hacking through the jungle there and you've made it. So well done for listening all the way through that if you found it difficult. So I do think it's worth talking more about Brexit on the podcast, and I plan to go through some of the vocabulary associated with this and also to revisit the main arguments in forthcoming episodes. Also, as we move closer to the referendum date on the 23rd of June, I'm sure that more things will happen in the news. There'll probably be more events and more stuff going on, and it will be interesting to keep an eye on the opinion polls. So watch out for more Brexit-related commentary in the near future. Talking of the opinion polls, what do the polls say? We didn't mention that. I'm going to search for that. Poll of polls. I'm searching for a poll of polls, right? A poll of polls is basically a poll that's made up of the results from lots of other polls. And I've gone to whatyouthinks.org whatyouthinks.org, which is a non-partisan information website on UK attitudes to the EU and the EU referendum. So this is, I believe, a reliable poll which collates lots of information from loads of other polls. So this is probably a pretty good summary at the moment. And this poll. Let's see, this is based on the latest average of six polls from the 17th of May to the 25th of May. So this is like the week that we've just had, essentially. This is the way it stands. And we seem to have 53% are in favour of remaining in the EU and 47% are in favour of leaving the EU. So that's what the poll of polls on whatukthinks.org is saying. There might be another poll on Financial Times. I'm going to have a look at that. The Financial Times also does its own poll of polls here. So the Financial Times, as of the 25th of May, suggests that 46% are in favour of staying, and 41% are in favour of leaving. So it looks like the Remain camp has got the edge at the moment. This Financial Times poll shows that there is actually a section in the middle there. So there's a percentage of people who just don't know. So what's that? 87 is in total. So what, there's 13% in the middle who don't really know yet. So that 13% in the middle is going to be absolutely crucial. And that those people who haven't decided yet are going to be very important. Now, my prediction, I mean, we don't know. It's really impossible. It's really, really difficult to predict this. Really hard, because as my dad said, this has never happened before. I'm not going to make a prediction. Okay, I'm not going to make a prediction. But what I am going to say is that I think when it comes down to the crunch, I think people tend to vote. They tend to be a bit cautious. I think that might be the deciding factor when it comes to making the decision on the referendum day, when people actually make their vote. Are they really going to vote? Like the Leave camp is going to be quite a risky choice. I think people tend to be a bit more cautious, but I'm not going to make a prediction. We'll just have to wait and see. So anyway, that was just like a little bit about the polls at this stage. So anyway, watch out for more Brexit-related commentary on Luke's English podcast in the near future. As ever, I am very keen for you to express your opinions on the website. You might have very different opinions to the ones expressed by my dad and by me in this episode. And I'd love to read those things. You know, I've got an open mind. I want to hear what you have to say. I want to read your comments and stuff. So Please do leave your comments on the page for this episode. What do you think? What do you think about my dad's opinions in this episode, and how would you vote in the referendum? Indeed, how are you going to vote if you're a UK citizen? How are you going to vote in this referendum? Should the UK leave the EU, or should the UK remain a part of the EU? Let us know your opinions. Now, in fact, let's do a Luke's English Podcast EU referendum of our own, shall we? Let's do our own LEP EU poll. Now, I wonder how you, the Lepsters, would vote in this referendum. And in fact, if you go to the page for this episode, I have opened up a Brexit poll. It's the Luke's English Podcast Brexit poll. So please visit and cast your vote. It's completely anonymous. You don't need to add your name, and you don't need to give your email address or anything. You just simply click leave or remain. Okay, so visit the page for this episode on my website. Scroll down until you find the Brexit poll and just click leave or remain. And let's see what the results will be. I'm very curious to see what the Lepsters would decide in this case. If it was based on listeners to this podcast, I wonder what would happen. Right. Thank you very much again for listening to this episode of Luke's English Podcast. There'll be more stuff coming your way soon, but for now, I would just say take care, goodbye, have a nice day, have a nice morning, have a nice evening, have a nice night, wherever you are, whoever you are, whatever situation you happen to be in when you're listening to this. Goodbye. Bye. 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 Thanks again for listening to Luke's English Podcast. For more information, visit teacherluke.co.uk.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
If you enjoyed this episode of Luke's English Podcast, consider signing up for Luke's English Podcast Premium. You'll get regular premium episodes with stories, vocabulary, grammar, and pronunciation teaching from me, and the usual moments of humour and fun. Plus, with your subscription, you will be directly supporting my work and making this whole podcast project possible. For more information about Luke's English Podcast Premium, go to teacherluke.co.uk/premium info.